At Her Spirit, we're here for you. We want to help you discover your potential, achieve your goals, ignite your fitness, find your community. Head to herspirit.co.uk and sign up for our core membership. Get access to our virtual classes, monthly challenges, expert advice, and track your progress in our health hub. You'll also find your very own cheerleading squad who will support you every step of the way. Use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 and get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Hi, it's Annie here. I just wanted to remind you that Her Spirit is supporting every woman over the coming challenging weeks. At Her Spirit, we believe in inspiring women to become fitter, stronger, and healthier. We believe your mind, body, and fuel are intrinsically linked, and taking small, achievable steps will lead to big changes. Her Spirit supports women of all shapes and sizes to achieve goals you never thought possible. And through our coaching team, we will support you every step of the way. Just sign up at herspirit.co.uk. A big thanks to our sponsors, MediChecks, who enable our podcast to happen. MediChecks offers an easy and affordable way to check your health from the comfort of your own home with their simple and personal at-home blood tests. From hormones and nutrition to cholesterol and diabetes, there is something for everyone. Visit medichecks.com to find out more. Together we've got this. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Her Spirit podcast. I'm absolutely determined today. It is going to be super, well, maybe not all of it, but it's got to be upbeat, Annie, hasn't it? Given where we are all now today. And I know this really gives a bit of a timeline to the podcast, but today is day one of lockdown two in England. Annie, how's it going?
I'm just going to take a really big pause there because, how I feel. It's a bit trickier. I haven't been at my best, but today, you know, somehow you give in. I don't like giving in. But anyway, to make things a bit happier for us today on the way to school, my son found out that Hot Xmas, as it's called, radio station is up and running. So we sang Christmas songs all the way to school. So you know what? You know, it's okay. You know, listen, Christmas is going to be difficult for a lot of people, but we can still sing and we can still laugh. So that's what we did this morning.
I'm going to start listening. And actually, I feel really lucky because last week it was half term, wasn't it? And I went to, there is a Christmas shop, literally all it does, it's massive, it's a warehouse. And all it does is sell Christmas stuff. And we didn't know what was going to happen, but we went there and we bought loads of Christmas things. So I'm thinking, when do I go with the Christmas? Is it like next week? I mean, I've never been before December, but I think that's what we've got to do. Bring the Christmas forward and start enjoying it.
Listen, you know, for me, it's always a difficult thing because, you know, you and I are both kind of doing pretty okay. There's a lot of people that aren't. But okay, let's like just try and spread some happiness, you know, communicate with friends, mm-hmm. do the best we can do to support people. And listen, you know, we haven't got loads of money in this house this year, but we can go out for walks. You know, we're privileged to live in the countryside. And so we just got to make the most of it until things change.
Now, I'm very, very much looking forward to our guest today because I feel like, and I often feel like that with people we invite onto this podcast. That's why I invite them, in fact. I've kind of followed her career and her ups and downs over quite a few years now. I feel like I know her and that I would love to spend a lot of time with her and have been slightly envious, actually, because she's a brilliant journalist of her. I mean, the way she writes, for example, Annie, is absolutely brilliant and insightful and sometimes very beautiful. And also she's had a really fun career. I'm not saying that I haven't at all, by the way. I've really enjoyed myself. But, you know, she's had great fun as well, it seems, from the outside. But there's a lot of backstory, which we're going to hear about today. So she is a fantastic writer, as I say. She's a mental health campaigner. She's won awards for the mental health campaigning. She is the fantastic Bryony Gordon. Very good morning to you, who writes for the Daily Telegraph.
Good morning. At the moment.
Well, you've written, were you one of the 3 a.m. girls?
Yeah, like, I don't like talking about that.
Don't you?
No, that was so long ago.
I mean, I used to read you then and go, my gosh, these girls, they are living the life.
I mean, I only did it for like 3 months and then I was like, I can't do this. This is not me. I was really bad at it. Like,
I'm sure you were because I remember your writing.
No, because I wanted to like be out getting drunk, but I didn't want to be like working. Do you know what I mean? And I also, yeah. I hated having to go up to celebrities and try and get stories off them. I was like, oh, this is gross. So I didn't last very long.
We can see you sitting in your house today, and you've got the most wonderful little, what have you got, like clips in your hair?
Do you know what? I bought these, like, they're like pink child's clips I've got them from like Flying Tiger for 50p because I'm class. I did actually buy them for myself, but I have this idea. And then my daughter, my 7-year-old daughter, stole them, but she's left them. She hasn't worn them today. And I just put them on because I quite like, they're cheering me up on an otherwise quite bleak day.
It's what we've got to do, isn't it? We're going to come to your book because, there's lots of reasons to invite you on, but it's cool. You've written another book, and I've read a couple of the other ones. This one is called Glorious Rock Bottom. We'll come to that in a while, because I think we need to hear so much about you, and then we'll hear what rock bottom was. And obviously, not obviously, but I said last week, Annie, it's not that glorious as well, Bryony, is it?
Oh my goodness. I have been listening to the audio version. I think it's utterly brilliant. I think it's going to help a lot of people. I'm sure it has. From my point of view, I kind of was just listening to it, just going, wow. Wow, the honesty. I think the honesty is absolutely brutal, but it's brilliant too, because it's not easy to be as honest as you have been in this book.
Well, it's a funny thing, because people always say, oh, it's really honest. On these mental health issues, I don't really know any other way to be. And it's actually very helpful to me to write about this stuff, because I can put it down in black and white on the page, and then it can't hurt me anymore, if that makes sense. And like I and also what happens is people get in touch with me and tell me about their stories. So when I first went into treatment for alcoholism, which is what Glorious Rock Bottom's about, I really thought I was the worst mother in the world and the only mother in the world who behaved in the way I did. And it very quickly became clear to me that I wasn't, you know. And alcoholism is very common, and it affects everyone, and it isn't just, you know, that kind of stereotype we have of sort of an old man on a bench with a you know, swigging from a bottle. And that is one way to be an alcoholic, but there are many other ways, you know. And I felt that the shame of it and the sort of isolation of it it kept me in it, and it made me really unwell. And if I'd known, I think that there were more people out there like me, doing the same things as me, feeling the same things as me, experiencing the same sort of traumas, I guess, as me, I might have got sober far quicker. But I didn't, and that's fine. And I'm here to tell the tale, and I'm very, very lucky to be alive. Do you know what I mean? It's that thing of like, so, but I really wanted to, you know, some of the most shameful things I had done or I'd experienced, it blew my mind that there were loads of other people out there who had experienced them too. Do you know what I mean? And it, you know, and it wasn't, in a way, it felt outrageous. It felt freakish. It felt all of those things, but it wasn't, you know. I'm not anything out of the ordinary, actually. I'm another person who became ill with a legal drug that's sold on supermarket shelves, which hooks a lot of people in. So I really just wanted to get that down on paper, and in the hope that it sounds very trite and cliched, but in the hope that it would help someone else.
Oh, I mean, it 100% will, and I know it has. There's so much to ask you. So you talked about there, didn't you, about doing these things that I was doing. So what, and you know, the comparison between the old man on the park bench. So what is it, for people who've not read the book, that you were doing?
So my drinking was very much, I didn't drink every day, and I didn't drink during the day, but it didn't really matter that I didn't do that, because I thought about alcohol all day, and it completely structured my life in a way. So if I had a big work thing on, say, a Tuesday morning, that meant I couldn't drink on a Monday evening, which meant I had to drink on a Sunday. And I had all these rules that I felt put me in control of my drinking. So I didn't drink until my daughter was in bed. I didn't drink spirits. I didn't drink wine. You know, I mean, I'd gone through all of those iterations of drinking. And I thought that gave me some control over my drinking, but actually it was just a sign that my drinking was controlling me, you know. And I, you know, every time I drank, I don't know, it's like, it's really difficult because my husband always used to say to me, why can't you just have one drink? And I'd be like, why can't you just fuck off? Sorry, I didn't mean to swear. But it genuinely doesn't like compute for me having one drink. So like, I can literally count on one hand the amount of times I went out and only had one drink. And it was probably because I was so unwell from the night before that I had that one drink. I could only have one drink. And, you know, when I started drinking, that was that, you know, I drank until I blacked out. And very often that happened in the garden. It happened in my sofa. You know, it wasn't sort of like dramatic or anything like that. But the consequences were there in my head every morning when I woke up. And also, you know, and occasionally what would happen was, about every 3 months, I would go on these momentous benders. Cocaine played a part in them. You know, I had a problem with that. And it was, you know, it was because, I mean, I don't know, to anyone who's listening, they'll probably think, oh, if you haven't taken it, cocaine basically, so, I mean, this isn't me trying to sell it or anyway, shape or form, but it sobers you up and enables you to carry on drinking. So it's a real, like, it goes hand in hand with binge drinking and it's very commonplace in the UK. You know, we think of it as some sort of glam, you know, like it's only the kind of the rich and the famous who do it, but it's everywhere. You know, as studies have shown, it's sort of in the water because that's how many people take it. And it's cheaper than buying a cup of coffee kind of thing. And it really, that took me to some really seedy places because cocaine does, do you know what I mean? So it sobers you up, allows you to carry on drinking, but then it takes you to a sort of a much darker place where seedy, sexual, you know. And so that brought me in quicker and I ended up in situations that were really not safe. You know, I was assaulted by someone while I was at a friend's 40th birthday. And I say assaulted, but it's still that word. Still, I struggle with that word because, you know, I basically allowed it. I kind of came to and it was happening and I allowed it to carry on happening because he'd been giving me cocaine all night, you know, and it was these really dark places that as a then 37-year-old mother, I shouldn't be finding myself in. So, you know, it was, yeah, those were my sort of rock bottoms, really.
At Her Spirit, we know how powerful women can be. We love your strength, your determination, your compassion. We love the energy that sparks when we connect and spur each other on. Her Spirit was created to ignite that flame of determination, to unleash your energy, to build your self-belief, and to help every woman find a way to your healthiest mind, body, and soul yet. We want to inspire 1 million women just like you to be active, healthy, and happy because you deserve it. Head to herspirit.co.uk, join our core membership and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. Join our monthly challenges, get access to the Her Spirit Health Hub and track your activity levels, mood, food, sleep and stress every single week with your own personalised dashboard. Get expert advice and join daily live classes that can be played back at any time. Plus, find the support that you need to get started and stay motivated. Just sign up at herspirit.co.uk and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
And you do describe, and I think Annie and I were both kind of taken aback at that, when you write that in the book, you do describe that. And I think you talked about your soul seeping out, which, you know, Bryony, gosh, was that rock bottom or was there a sort of series of rock bottom?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and there's always another rock bottom if you allow it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm under no...
Also, if you'd carried on.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's important to say that a lot of those things weren't, you know, worse things had happened in the past when I was drinking and drugging. But it was like, so when I try and work out why it was that I decided I had to stop then, it was kind of like, I talk about my rock bottom, really, we can talk about all these like shocking moments where we're like, I have to change, and there's a light bulb moment. But what I say in the book is actually, it's a million little moments that all lead up to that rock bottom. And for me, it was like my self-esteem was non-existent. Like I had been hollowed out by self-loathing. And I knew that if I carried on, well, I didn't know that I would survive. So I thought if I carried on drinking, I was going to die. I was either going to die by choosing to kill myself, which was something that had crossed my mind on several occasions, or I was going to die by accidentally choking on my own vomit or falling down some stairs or whatever. You know, we hear about these things. Or worst of all, I was going to die by continuing to live in this like Groundhog Day existence of shame. And I knew it had to change. I didn't know how it was going to change because, you know, the moment I can see myself that day when I knew I had to stop sitting on my bed and I was like, I know I can't drink again, but I have no idea how I'm going to manage to not drink again. Like I couldn't imagine a life without alcohol, but I knew I had to somehow make it happen. So, you know, it was weird and there were lots of things that precipitated it because I was very high, you know, like we talk about a high functioning alcoholic, and really, I think that's just an alcoholic who hasn't been found out yet. Do you know what I mean? That's all it is. And I was like, the year I got sober, it was like the things that led up to it were, I'd like signed up to do a marathon, right? And I was like, that's going to stop me from drinking. Do you know what I mean? I was like, you know, and this is something I hear quite a lot with other sober women. They're like, we'll go on a yoga retreat. I'll go on, you know, I'll do this, I'll do that. You know, that'll stop me. And, you know, it didn't actually, to put it bluntly. In fact, if anything, my drinking ramped up a bit. Obviously, I stopped running for the duration of the marathon, stopped drinking for the duration of running the marathon. But like I was like, I would go on a training run and then I'd be like, right, let's go to the pub. And my husband would be like, you can't drink a pint for every mile that you've run. And I'd be like, au contraire, you know, of course I can. And honestly, guys, I don't know how I survived that. Do you know what I mean? Let alone, but it also, what it did was it also showed me that there was this other way of living. Do you know what I mean? Whereby you could get up and go for a run and you could, your focus in life didn't have to be purely on drinking. Do you know what I mean? And and that was like, oh, it was quite, I was starting to sort of see these other ways of living and these other healthier ways of living and meet these people who, and so it all kind of, you know, it's, I don't think it's any coincidence that it all happened in the same year.
I think it's important, really important to point out that alcoholism is a disease. Like many people will say, well, it's not just stop drinking. It is not as straightforward as that. It really isn't. And there is definitely evidence to show that it can be hereditary.
Mm-hmm. Well, they call it a family illness. I mean, neither of my parents are alcoholics, but, you know, it does... It is a very, you know, I think it's, listen, I'm not anti-alcohol. What I am anti is us not acknowledging how alcohol does affect some people, you know, and it's a legal drug, as I said earlier. It's a depressant that masquerades remarkably well as a relaxant, right? So it's like an Oscar-winning actress in it, you know, it'll like, it really sucks you in. And so what happens is people get stuck in this rut where they're like, I need that thing to relax. But then the way I always see it now is because, don't get me wrong, like 3 and a bit years in, I still occasionally think, God, I really like a drink. Do you know what I mean? And what I always try and remind myself is that, you know, if I was to pick up a drink now, whatever I was drinking on would still be there tomorrow, but it would come back with interest, right? And then I'm like, God, no, let's not do that. So it's a really, you know, for me, it's a really easy trap to put people fall into. And we live in a very alcohol drenched society. I mean, you only have to look at, you know, the focuses and the, you know, the things that have seemed very important in the media during the pandemic. It's about like, well, the pubs, you know, even just this week. So we're day one of lockdown two, but you know, lots of the stories have been about, well, some pubs will be able to sell takeaway pints if you can order it on your phone. And I'm like, who cares? Do you know what I mean? Like, why is that your focus? You know, why is the focus not will mental health services still be able to run? Will severely ill people still be able to access, you know, their therapy? Will, you know, will we be able to, you know, like the gyms are shut. Do you know what I mean? When will they be able to, yeah.
No, I was just going on that point. So yeah, it was really interesting. You know, yesterday I went to the gym like many other people, as it turned out, because it was last night. And so did Annie, hands up, last night. And so did Mel, last night before lockdown. And it was genuinely, in a kind of optimistic but also really depressing kind of way, rammed. It was really clear that people felt that they needed to go and get that last what lifting or whatever, swimming. The swimming pool was full. And you're right, you know, this in some way should be the story. And it is the story, actually. There's massive campaign, isn't there, to try and keep the pools open, et cetera. But you make a very, very good point about the focus. And just one quick thing from Nigat, who's a wonderful doctor who we speak to quite a lot here as part of our sort of the Her Spirit community. She said social drinking has significantly increased in lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of statistics about it. And you know, this isn't me shaming anyone for it because, I mean, hello, we're going through, this is a massive, like, I hesitate to use words like traumatic because it just sounds so dramatic. But this year has been like a giant traumatic event for lots of people, you know. If you wrote this down in a novel, like, I was talking to a friend this morning about this, like, oh, and now you're only allowed to meet up with six people, but you have to be home by 10 p.m. And, you know, you'd be like, this is like something out of a Margaret Atwood dystopia, you know. And it's like, and yet we're all like, OK, let's just do it. You know, like none of us have processed it in any way, you know. And so I understand that drinking is, and you've got people who have lost their jobs, people whose livelihoods are like on the line, there's uncertainty everywhere. Like, of course, what are you going to do? You're going to fucking sit down and drink if you haven't been taught any other coping skills. And let's face it, in this country, we don't grow up being taught other coping skills. Like, when I was a kid, what I saw in my house was, not my parents aren't alcoholics, but what I saw at the end of a stressful day was, oh, darling, let's have a glass of red wine. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, these are the things that we learn. And so it's, you know, so I don't throw any shade on people that have found themselves drinking more in lockdown and during this pandemic. And what I say is I absolutely understand it. And there have been times during this pandemic where I have been, you know, I felt like an arm's length away from relapsing. Do you know what I mean? And thank God I haven't. But like, this stuff it can be really dangerous for people. And so, as I said, I'm not anti-alcohol. I'm very much of the opinion that if you can have a couple of drinks and it doesn't impact on your life, you know, with dinner or whatever, like, life's too short, let's face it. Like, just carry on, do you know what I mean? But if it is the focus of your evening and there is nothing else, do you know what I mean? And that's all it's about and you can't stop at one or two, like, maybe have a look at why that is. And maybe we should be looking more at that, you know. And what happens is the government put on bottles, you know, drink responsibly. And then we look at it and go, well, why can't I drink responsibly? I should be able to drink responsibly. It's all my fault. And it's not. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is a chemical. It's a thing that ups, you know, it fiddles around with the chemistry of your brain.
Bryony, I don't want to talk too much about the book because I want to give people the opportunity to be able to read it themselves. But you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago about sort of the real rock bottom when you decided to call it a day, and it was a weekend when you were supposed to be going to see your father-in-law. Mm-hmm. And you went out with a friend that you called out. She wasn't really a friend, but a so-called friend, because she was a good drinking buddy and you knew there was a chance that not only would you be drinking, but she'd bring some coke along with her and cocaine and you'd have a great night. And you actually never made it home, and you never made it to your father-in-law. So the next day he went off with your daughter. So I just want to bring, I hope you don't mind, but bring Harry, your husband, into this, because he, by the sounds of it, has been the rock, I guess, that has kept together for you.
Yes, he's great. I mean, I'm lucky to have him. You know, I always say this, like, lots of people sober up and realize they're married to an asshole. I sobered up and realized I was the asshole. And no, but it's true. And like, he knew I had a problem long before I did, and he helped me through it. And he used to say to me, you're not a bad person, Bryony. You just are an ill person who sometimes does bad things because of that illness. And I
You know, I always used to think that I was the one.
Made me cry,
No, it's true. And he, you know, like Harry is like, he grew up, you know, on army bases. And I always used to think, oh, he's so like, he's just so buttoned up. Like he last expressed an emotion in 1983 or whatever. Whereas I was just like this uncontained mess. But I thought I was the one more in touch with myself. And actually that was, he was just like, this girl, like, obviously, in fact, I had this conversation with him last night. I was like, why did you stay with me? And he's like, because you're pretty and you make me laugh. And he was like, you know that when men get stopped, he's like, you've got nice eyes. I'm like, no, Harry, that's not why you stayed with me. Because there's plenty of women out there who have nice eyes who you could have, you know. He's like, because you're funny, because you make me laugh, because I enjoy your company. And I remember like pushing him on this when I was like, you know, and so people do lot. That is the question lots of people ask me, is like, I can tell they want to say like, how did this marriage survive this, you know? And, you know, and I don't know is the answer, but it did and it has. And we are like, you know, we just work together. He is, you know, he obviously gets something out of me that I, just as much as I get something out of him. And yeah, he was very rock solid. And he is one of those people that can just have one drink. In fact, he's doing this like, well, he's just obviously had to stop it because he was on this gym training, like lifting course thing. He'd been doing for 2 months and they were like, you can't drink. And he was like, that's fine. That's not a problem. My wife doesn't drink. And they were like, oh, that's great. You come from this really healthy like family there. And he's like, no, you don't understand. My wife doesn't drink because she's an alcoholic. but for him, it's just like not been an issue. He's just put it down and he's like, great. Yeah, it's fine. Like, you know, he's like, I think I'll just carry it on till January. And I'm like, what? Like, even as someone who hasn't had a drink for like 3.5 years or whatever, I'm like, I don't understand how you could just decide as a, you know, to just go, well, I'm just not going to have a drink now until February. I'm like,
and how is it for you to be with him when he, I mean, obviously he enjoys your drink, he's not a big drinker, but how is it for you for him to have a drink? Like, would he have a glass of wine at home?
Yeah, I don't mind it. In fact, I find it very helpful because it's a reminder of why I can't drink. Because I have like no, I look at it and I'm like, who wants to have one drink? Like, he'll literally just open a beer and we'll sit down and we'll watch like Below Deck or whatever trash we're watching on the television at the time of an evening. And then he's like, that's it. And I'm like, oh, that's so, like, it's genuinely easier for me to have none than one. And I'm sure there's many people out there who will resonate with. So it doesn't bother me at all. I quite like it because it is like, okay, that's why I can't. The thing I can't do is I cannot be around people. I can't go to things or be around people that are drinking like in the way that I used to drink. But that's fine because, you know, funnily enough, life this year has made that there's precious few opportunities anyway for me to be, you know. But I did find, you know, it was interesting, like in the summer during that lockdown, I found it quite like triggering. Again, there's a word I don't like to use, but like to see the people you really saw. Where I live in South London, I live between two big commons, and you really saw how alcohol was the release, you know, like it was like living between two Glastonbury festivals. And I get it, but I found it like really like, God, there's a bit of me that goes, you know, I just wanted to sit on a bit of grass and get fucked up.
And for you, Bryony, how do you manage that? Do you still go to regular counselling AA sessions? Because most people have to, don't they?
So I always say, I'm not a drinker anymore, but I'll always be an alcoholic, you know, and I think that's a really important thing to remember. So I still see my counsellor from rehab every week. And I go to 12-step meetings 3 to 4 times a week. And they are, you know, they have been transformational for me. And, you know, you're not supposed to talk about them. So I, you know, but that is, you know, it would be disingenuous for me to go, like, as if I just got sober through by myself. I didn't get sober by myself at all. I got sober through, you know, a 12-step program, and I stay sober through that. So I think it's really important for me to say that. And I wouldn't have my sobriety without it, if that makes sense. So it's a constant it's a constant thing. But, you know, I always remind myself that even when it's hard, it's never as hard as the alternative, you know. The effort that I used to put into drinking, I'm like, yeah, you can just go and sit in a meeting for an hour online. Like, come on, Brian, you don't even have to leave the house at the moment. It's like, you know, like, so it's, you know, I remember someone saying that to me as like, I'd be like, at the beginning, I was like, oh, I don't want to go to do that silly 12-step stuff. And I remember someone saying to me, Bryony, you would have trekked through snow and a gale to get to the pub when you're drinking days. You can get off your ass and go to a 12-step meeting. And I'm like, okay. And I always feel better at the end of one. I've never felt worse, you know. It's like exercise.
I want to come to exercise. There's so much to talk to you about mental health mates as well. But just going back to the way you got sober, you made a really good friend, and that was seemed to be a really important part of your recovery. A friendship is a powerful thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually that is at the heart of 12-step programs. It's about fellowship, you know. And it's probably my best, you know, one of my, Holly, who I met in rehab, and she is, you know, we're the same age, got exactly the same sobriety date, which is weird. We live like a mile away from each other and have kids the same age. And that thing of thinking I was the only one out there behaving like that, and all along, a mile away from me, there was Holly. I mean, it's for the best that we didn't meet while we were still drinking, because it could have been catastrophic. But, you know, and I kind of think that's pretty amazing, you know. So I still speak to her every day and see her all the time, or at least when I can, you know, restrictions permitting. And, yes. You know, yeah, I do think it's really important. But I also think it's really interesting that, and I think this is something that a lot of, like, I certainly found that when I, even before I got sober, I started like attracting, or I started like bringing sober people into my life without really realizing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, does that make sense? Like, I'd meet someone and they'd be like, oh, I don't drink anymore, but I used to drink all the time. And I'd be like, what? And it was like, I say in the book, it's like, it was like collecting Pokemon cards. Do you know what I mean? I was like, oh, this is, you're fascinating. You know? And so, yeah, so my friendship group's very much, like, and actually most of my friends had grown out of drinking long before I did, so.
Well, I want to talk to you about, so let's talk about where exercise fits in all of this, because you've done some amazing stuff. You've been out for a run already this morning, haven't you? You ran the marathon.
That is amazing in itself.
Yeah, I know. I mean, because I think I interviewed you on BBC Breakfast before. I think it was before you were sober, actually. You talk about sort of running towards the pint as well with that. I mean, that's sort of incredible, isn't it? But it has also been an important part of the recovery.
So my first marathon, I was not sober. And
you made the point you were sober on the marathon, but apart from that, no.
I was not sober about an hour after the marathon had finished.
Wow.
And the next year I did the marathon again with my friend Jada, and we did it in our underwear as a kind of to show that women of all shapes and sizes could, you know, alcohol running is for everyone. Cause I'm sort of like a size 18. I'm not, you know, I'm not a skinny biddy. Anyway, but I had genuinely thought in my sort of like naivety that running a marathon like 8 months sober was going to be way easier than running it when I was drinking. And I was wrong. Like, genuinely, it was so much harder. And I do think that's because I wasn't running. Like, the first marathon, I hadn't obviously allowed myself to drink for like 5 days before. So I had this thing, this goal. I was like, I'm going to go and get sloshed tonight. And then the second one, I remember it was the hottest London marathon on record. Do you remember that one where and I got to the end of it and I literally was like, how am I not dead? Like, how am I not dead from that the marathon I've just run? But also, how am I not dead from the marathon I ran last year where I then went on a bender? Straight afterwards, like, so yeah, I have no idea, but like running is a pretty important thing for me, and it's for my head, you know, not for my not for it's for the gains, not the losses, if you see what I mean.
And do you you run today, do you run every day? Do you have, you know, are you training for something? How does it work?
Well, I was training for the London Marathon, and then I obviously, like, I was too lazy to take on the virtual one. But no, I'm not training for anything at the moment. So part of the thing I do is I did like a virtual 10K the other weekend for this thing that came off the back of me and Jada, my friend, running the marathon in our underwear, which is Celebrate You, which is a 10K where last year we had it, and it was during the Vitality 10K. We had a wave, and it was 1,000 women running around London in their underwear. Like, we had women with all different body experiences, so women with cancer, plus size, small size, you know, like everything, you know. And then obviously this year we couldn't do it, but we did do a virtual. So running is very important to me. It's very close to my heart. And I don't run every day. In fact, I've put myself back on couch to 10K, which I really love, because otherwise I can get a bit, if I don't have like a big thing to train for, I can be a bit like, oh. But it's like, right, no, go out. So I probably run like 3 or 4 times a week, I would say.
And I guess that is important to you. I mean, certainly from my point of view, I think we find exercise is a massive part in your sort of, not, it's not just your physical health, it is your mental health, isn't it? And keeping you on the straight and narrow. I know that if I'm having a really crap day, I'll go for a run and actually I come back and you're a whole lot better. And so for you, would you say that has also been very important, keeping you on track?
Yeah. And I think when I was growing up, and you know, this is the same for lots of people, it was all about like who, you know, it was about like who could be the fastest or the strongest. And, you know, I was never the fastest or the strongest. And I kind of thought that if I couldn't be the fastest or the strongest, then I shouldn't do exercise at all. And that was very much the kind of, and it's a bit like saying to someone, well, if you don't have a Michelin star, you should never cook. You know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. And for me, the transformation came, like, for me in my 20s, you know, and I had eating disorders, and I was very, you know, and I was in, you know, drug addiction and alcoholism. And exercise for me is very much about punishment. It was about making my body smaller. And then for me, the real shift came when I started to do exercise for the gains and not the losses. So it wasn't about shrinking myself. It was about the clarity it brought, you know, the endorphins that it produced. And, you know, and it so for me, it's like, it's not about being the fastest. And so whenever someone says to me, oh, what time did you get in a marathon? I'm like, what's your time? And they'll be like, well, I haven't done a marathon. I'm like, well, exactly, so fuck off. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't get it. I'm like, what's your interest? Like, what? Oh, you're the fastest. I'm like, I probably walk faster than I run. Do you know what I mean? But that, like, it's just the point is I'm out there and I'm doing it. And I, you know, and I think that kind of attitude, it really puts people off. You know, it does. Women are like, oh.
But in fairness to marathon runners out there, Bryony, it is a bit of a thing, isn't it? It's like, what's your time?
And, well, to some marathon runners it is, but to some people, you know, look, I think that when you in this community, as you obviously, you guys obviously are, I mean, you're like you're a proper athlete, Annie, and you know, Louise is a proper athlete too. But like, what I mean is, it's like you forget that most people have not run marathons, and it's a big thing. So just the fact of taking part in one is enough, without going, oh, are you doing, you know, is it how quick is your mile, kilometer? It's like, oh, just let me get on with it.
So you did it. You didn't write your mile pace times on your hand then when you went into your marathon.
No, I just was like, where? At what point did people start giving me Haribo? You know, that was the thing. It was like, for me, it was the best, like the best days. Like, people are like shouting your name, going, come on, because everyone's got, you know, we've all got our names on our fronts. Come on, Bryony, here's some Haribo. I'm like, it's a chance for everyone to feel like a rock star for a moment. Do you know what I mean? It's magic. I'm like, more Haribo.
You've just made me, I've been laughing my head off for the last 5 minutes. So many brilliant things, because I'm going to remember that about the marathon, because actually not even, you know, lots of people don't do 10Ks, and people always say to me, and we've talked about this before, oh, Louise, you're so competitive. I'm like, no, I'm not. I just do it because I like it, and I like it for all lots of different reasons, but including
the Snickers bars. Do you see what I mean? And then that thing about you know, don't cook. You know, you're not a Michelin star, so therefore don't cook. You're so right. We you know, we build ourselves into these impossible situations when we can never be good enough. And actually, all of those things you're saying are just brilliant.
Well, it's like my daughter is, because she's my daughter, she ain't winning any races. Do you know what I mean? But like she's, you know, like she's, because I don't know, there just must be something in our genes, which means that we're just not very fast. It's not that she's, you know, she's a little 7 year old. She's not, but, and she, people go, kids are like, let's have a race. And she's like, oh God. And I'm like, Edie, we run for fun. It doesn't matter. You know, like it's all about, that's what it's about. It's not about winning. Like I feel like I win every time I get up. And the other thing I feel about running is that, because I do get that if you are running, if you've been running for a long time, if you've done a marathon, you know, maybe working on your time and your mileage or whatever, or your, you know, your pace is a way to kind of complete, you know, to move on and to carry on in some way. But for me, it's like running is something that I do. I'm a long time runner, but there will be periods in my life where for whatever reason it falls by the wayside because I've got a big work project, you know what I mean? Or because I'm not very well or whatever. And so the joy is that you can always just start again at the beginning and those gains are still there. There's still that amazing joy I have when I'm like, oh, I'm on week 7 of couch to 10K and I've just run for 25 minutes. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, oh, because 7 weeks ago I couldn't do that or I couldn't be asked to do that. I probably could do it, but I wasn't. Do you know what I mean? And like it's a wondrous thing, and it's like each week realizing that your body can do a little bit more than you thought your body could the week before. And there'll be people listening now who this year, you know, this year more than any people have, you know, our lives have been changed for whatever reason. Maybe someone has experienced COVID and has found that they just can't get back to fitness. Maybe people have had to spend long periods indoors shielding or whatever, you know. So it's always there, you know, it's always there to go back to. And I think that it's really important that we run for fun, we run for our, you know, our hearts and our heads rather than for how it makes us look or how impressive we are and how quick, you know. I love it, you know, like also I see men out there running who are like super fast and I'm like, well done you. But like you babes are not carrying around a pair of 38J tits on you. Do you know what I mean? So I'm just not going to be as fast as you. Do you know what I mean? Like I am a size 18. I've got just a lot going on, but I'm still going to do it. I'm still going to get out there and you ain't stopping me. And I think that, you know, all credit to people out there who were like, wanting to kind of rival Kipchoge or whatever, and they've got their like Nike Fly Vapor whatever's on. Do you know what I mean? But none of them have to worry about me.
But I guess that, you know, that is life. That's the wonderful thing about life. You know, you, and we'll talk about it now, are an amazing writer and journalist. I would probably never be an amazing writer, but I can run quite fast, even at the age of 50. So, you know, that's the wonderful thing about life. You know, everyone has different talents and enjoys different things. And that's what makes the world go round. But maybe time to move on to you and your career. Let's leave the whole wine stuff to one side and the running stuff. What an amazing career for someone who dropped out of uni studying history of art. How did your life start, your career in journalism?
Well, it's I always get a bit embarrassed talking about this because I may not come from a family of alcoholics, but I do come from a family of journalists. So like journalism writing goes back like I don't know how many generations. And so it was literally the only thing I ever kind of had any real... No, that's not true. There was a time when I wanted to be an Arsenal footballer, and there was a time when I wanted to be like a marine biologist. But really, it was from a very young age, I'd come down in the morning and there'd be all the newspapers on the table. And so, you know, the short answer is nepotism. But the more complicated and full smart answer is that I really wanted to do it. So I that was that really. I just raided my mum's contact book. She was like, what makes you think you're any more special than anybody else who wants to be a journalist? And I'm like, nothing, but I would be like stupid not to steal your address book and get some work experience. So yeah, so that's how it started. I did some work experience at the Sunday Express back in 1998, and it largely involved doing stunt like I was making tea. I got, and I was working with like journalists who were quite, you know, now like I would do research for like James O'Brien, you know, lots of political journalists and stuff like that. And then I just started, that was the kind of gateway in.
Oh no, I like that. And I like that it's a passion, it's clearly a passion for you. In this career, in this amazing career, one of the highlights that kind of went worldwide was your interview with Prince Harry, your podcast. I mean, what an incredible thing to do.
Yeah.
Because it was really insightful, wasn't it, about him?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I signed up to do the marathon, I was doing it for Heads Together, which was the campaign that he did with his brother and sister-in-law. And
I love the way you say brother and sister-in-law. I mean, you know, it's just only the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, but...
With William and Catherine, sorry. I found myself suddenly, because I got invited to the launch of it as someone who wrote a lot about... So I was writing a lot about mental health even before I got sober. So as a kind of framework for everyone is that I, from a very young age, had very, very... Well, all obsessive compulsive disorder is bad, but... So to say very bad, but it, you know, there were long periods in my childhood where I felt unable to leave my house and so really drinking, you know, that's where the alcohol fits in. It was the thing that I used to kind of help my OCD, although of course it made it worse. But I was writing a lot about my OCD, and I'd started up this thing called Mental Health Mates, which is basically walks for people to get out and about and meet up with each other, you know, and come together and talk and walk and talk without fear of any judgment. And this was 5 years ago now. It's like blows my mind. So I, on the back of that, I got invited to the launch of Heads Together, and that was when I was like, all right, I'm gonna volunteer to do the marathon for them because then I'll stop drinking. But I didn't know like the world it was going to open up to me, and I did a lot of work with them through that. Got on really well. I got on well with all of them, but I got on particularly like I don't know. There was like I felt a connection with Harry. And so I asked him if he'd be the first guest on my podcast.
What a way to go!
I fully expected that he'd like, I'd just be like, he'd be like, well, I didn't like, I went through his people, obviously. I didn't like go, excuse me, hi, would you come on my podcast? But he said yes. And then, yeah. And so then we had that chat that it was like, I remember going in there and being like, I'm sure he's just going to talk like very generally about mental health and the importance of talking about it. And then he was like, would you mind if, because obviously, so I worked with the Telegraph, so the podcast is produced by the Telegraph. So obviously the Telegraph had sent like this army of tech people to make, and he kind of walked into the room and went, like, my faith, like, what? And he was like, Bryony, would you mind if I just had a chat with you quickly? And he was like, would you mind if it was just you and me? Because what I'm about to talk to you about, I think I'd feel much more comfortable if it was just us in the room. And I was wow. like, yeah, sure. And that was the moment I knew that he was going to be like, but the thing about him is that he is, I don't know, I find it so strange when people ask me about, they don't find it strange when they ask me about him, obviously, because he's Prince Harry, do you know what I mean? But I have only ever encountered this very, very normal bloke. It's weird. I find it really weird because I know him a little bit. I know Meghan a little bit, you know, and I've been around that. I've been around her gaff and stuff like that. And but they're very, I mean, we're not like best friends, but we get on well and they're really love, you know, and we do a lot of work together, you know, so, and they're very normal, which is like, people are like, yeah, right, Bryony. Do you know what I mean? But they are. So I find it very weird talking about them because to me, everyone, like this is the thing, right? Everyone, it doesn't matter whether you're a prince or you're, you know, everyone, the great leveler, the great leveler is mental health, right? So you could be somewhere and you can have someone who's, I don't know, like just got out of prison, someone who is a politician, someone who's a prince, someone who's a, do you know what I mean? Someone who works on the checkout in Asda or whatever. And if you talk to them about something like anxiety or depression, or you bring up suicide figures, you know, that is the thing that they will, all of their, everything else will fall away, because everyone there will have a story, and it may not be their story that they're telling. It may be someone close to them. Do you know what I mean? But they will all be united, and that's the thing. So it's, you know, it's, it sort of strips everything else away, if that makes sense. So yeah, when I was chatting to him for the podcast, it was just like, it was like this, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that went, I mean, that went global. It was, I mean, and people should go back and listen to it, because it's a, you know, it's a brilliant, he was just incredibly honest with you. And we're going to run out of time soon. Annie, have you got a question? I've got so many. We'll have to whiz through them. Go on.
I mean, I think we're in very difficult times at the moment. We're talking a lot about mental health, and we know that mental health issues are on the increase. You wrote a book, Mad World, which talked a lot about obsessive compulsive disorders, depression and bulimia. I mean, in terms of the times we're in now, what would you be your advice to someone going through a really difficult time in lockdown? What's their, you know, their first port of call?
Okay, so I've just finished a book that's coming out in January, which is called No Such Thing as Normal. And it's all the things I've learned about being mentally well from being mentally ill. And at the heart of it is a big section on how to access help, because we hear so often about how bad mental health provision is in the UK, which is an important thing for us to be campaigning about. But in itself, if you're in crisis, it's not actually that helpful, right? So the first thing I want to say is that no one has ever got better from a mental health issue by not talking about it. So the thing that all mental illnesses and all mental health issues have in common, be it from anxiety through to psychosis and beyond, is that they lie to you, they isolate you, and they tell you you're a freak and that no one else is going to understand what you're going through. And that's just bullshit. So not only does someone understand what you're going through, but there is someone out there right now who is going through what you are going through, right? And so the moment that you reach out and ask for help in whatever way, you are breaking through that chink. You're not cured, but you're certainly on the starting road to recovery. So the more you keep it inside, the worse it is going to get. Okay. And that's just, and it's also important to remember that a lot of the things that you don't feel like doing or feel like doing will probably be your mental illness. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, it's this weird thing where it's like, I describe it in the book as like the invasion of the body snatchers. Do you know what I mean? And the voice of that, the voice of that mental illness is so indistinguishable from your own. So it's that thing of like, I don't want to get out of bed. You know, I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to talk to someone about this. That is your mental illness taking ground in your mind. Okay. So that's the thing to do. You've got to do the opposite of what you want to do, which is incredibly hard. Okay. So, but there are so many different places out there. You know, you can self-refer for IAPT, which is which are talking therapies, if you've got a GP in England. So you can go online and do that. Every area in England has an NHS mental health crisis line now, which got set up during the first lockdown. You can Google those. There are places like Shout. So Shout, and I'm just going to Google that now, the number. Sorry, so you can hear me. So Shout is a crisis text line, which was set up with the legacy money from Heads Together. And if you text SHOUT to 85258, that there is a 24/7 manned crisis counsellors there who can talk to you. And that's often very, that helps a lot of people, because they're too scared to actually call up and speak to someone. So it's a good starting point. Obviously, then you have the Samaritans, whose number is, hang on. This is the one useful thing of being on online. You can call them 116 123 for free. And the thing to remember about the Samaritans is that it's completely anonymous. So your number doesn't flash up. They don't know where you are. It won't show up on your bill if you're worried about any of that. And it's non-judgmental listening. And then, yeah, there are all sorts of things out there. You know, your GP is like the starting point. And there, you know, at the moment, the message I would put out is that what happened in the first lockdown, and I don't know when this goes out, whether we will be in, but there's all this talk about being a burden on the NHS. And that is not helpful to people in mental health crisis, because people in mental health crisis feel like a burden on people anyway, right? So what we need to, and you know, you did really feel in the press conference that the Prime Minister gave on the night of Halloween, Fright Night, was that we mustn't stop accessing other NHS services. So it's really important, if you are feeling in crisis with your mental health, do get in touch with your GP, okay? And do, you know, if you feel like you have any sort of like feelings of ending your, about suicidal ideation, as we call it, you need to talk to someone about it. They're not going to take you away. You're not going to be, you know what I mean? It's, this is all, that the people are trained and they're there to hear it and to do stuff about it. And, you know, and it may be that they're the waiting lists are, you know, I don't, it depends where you are and what, you know, what part of the country you're in. But there are lots of other support things set up. So mental health charities that have phone lines like Mind, Young Minds, you know, there's so many out there. And then, of course, the other thing which I should mention, being that I founded it, is Mental Health Mate.
That's gone massive, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's all over the country. Now, obviously, at the moment, we can't meet for walks, but most of the walk leaders have taken them onto Zoom. So it doesn't matter where. So if they, so even if you live in, say, Liverpool, you could go to a Zoom of a walk, you know, a walk that happens in London or Bristol or wherever. Do you know what I mean?
And this sounds really stupid. Do they actually go on the walk while they're talking?
No.
Right, okay, so you chat.
You would normally, but at the moment it's Zoom. Yeah. And, you know, and we're, and obviously as soon as they're allowed back in. And if you wanted to start setting up, and also there's the other thing of the option of setting up your own walk in your own area if there isn't one.
So the idea behind it, Bryony, people don't know. They go, they meet up and they just walk. I mean, I say just walk, but they talk.
Because walking, A, it's the, like, that's the thing, is it, if we're struggling to get out of the house, because that's, as I said earlier, you know, mental illness wants you inside. It wants you alone. Do you know what I mean? At least knowing that you can get out of the house and meet other people who will understand, it's a safe place. And also walking. The thing about walking is when you're side by side someone, you don't have to look them directly in the eye. And it does make conversation a lot easier if you're someone who suffers from a lot of social anxiety. And it's a really wonderful thing, you know, and then Zoom, so I hope, you know, and, you know, so, but the Zoom, obviously we can't do the walks at the moment, but the Zooms are there, and you can find out, you can either go to the Instagram, which is at Mental Health Mates, or, the website, which is mentalhealthmates.co.uk.
Bryony, you've done amazing work. Annie, I've got a couple of other questions I want to ask. Have you got anything you want to ask her before we let her go? Because time is ticking away.
No, she's not allowed to go. She's going to stay with us all day.
I know. She's made me laugh. She's made me cry. Go on, honey.
No, you fire away. You fire away.
So, yeah, two things. First of all, and this is really, you know, you've given so much good advice, but we have been asking people for their five top tips for your best year yet. I mean, you've probably given more than five, Bryony, but have you got anything else you'd like to add? Any, you know, quick ones?
For your best year, yeah. I mean, listen, the thing I try to remember the whole time is we're just all trying our hardest and trying to do our best. And I think it's like to go easy on yourself right now and not, you know, and not have any expectations and maybe rewrite what the expectations are. So it could be, it doesn't have to be like, I am going to run a marathon or whatever by the end of 2020 or, you know, like just, you know, start small and, you know, remember that this is not going to last forever. You know, it just isn't. And I don't know, there's the Mary Oliver poem that I saw the other day, which is, it's on sorrow, I think. And it said one of the things from it is someone I loved gave me a box of darkness. And it took me years to realize that that too was a gift. And like, it can sound so trite and like, oh, look for the positives or whatever. But like, I don't know, like this has happened. So I can't rally, I can't rail against it. Like this is where we are. Do you know what I mean? So let's look for the lessons. Let's look for what we can learn from it. And, you know, and try and, I don't know, like my biggest tip for sort of survival really, and for mental resilience and for getting through stuff, is to take negatives and turn them into positives. And I don't know how that looks to everyone, and I don't know, but you know, it may be like, it, yeah, like this is shit, so why don't we try and, like, it could be like, let's set up a WhatsApp group for my street to check everyone's okay, which is probably something loads of people have done this year, you know. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's like we're allowed to meet up with one other person, right? This is shit. Why don't I every day call on someone I know who is maybe, you know, vulnerable or not vulnerable, because obviously you're not allowed to, but, you know, who might need help, and force them out for a walk. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's
a really good idea.
It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be like some massive thing, you know. We all change the world in our tiny little ways every day, you know, and I think that's important to remember.
And finally, my last thought for you, Bryony, is there's one thing that, I mean, I try not to watch this, but do you know what? I really look forward to it. And apparently you dream about going on Strictly. I don't want to go on Strictly, but I love watching it. Come on, Bryony, you'd be brilliant.
And I wrote about this the other day. Like, when I was a little girl, I used to listen to like boy band music when I was walking to school, and imagine like being like in the video with the boy band. And now, as a 40-year-old woman, I like run along and I'm listening to like Beyonce or whatever. And I've got like this playlist for the songs I would do if I ever got to go on Strictly. Now, this is like dream, because like I'm not famous. Do you know what I mean? So it would be like Bryony, like literally no one knows who you are, but like it would be, it's like my fantasy of what I would do if I won the lottery. It would be like what I would do if I ever got famous would go on Strictly and be like, I'd have to dance with Anton.
With Anton.
And in my fantasy, they're like, the judges are like, at the beginning, they're like, oh dear, she's not very good. But then they're like, I'll get to like the final. I probably won't win it, but like, I'll, you know, in my fantasy, I'll get to the final and they'll be like, you embody fun, Bryony. You've just shown that you can do it. You don't need to be a brilliant dancer. You just need the grit and the determination. Yes. And I'll be like wobbling my boobs and my ass.
Oh, Bryony.
That's how I get through. That's how I get through days, basically. Massive fucking daydreaming, as if I'm 14 and not 40.
Oh, I'm going to take the daydreams. Oh, Bryony, you have been absolutely wonderful guest today. So much really, really good information there. And, you know, just... as I say, you've made me cry, made me laugh, everything. I don't want to go on Strictly, but I'm going to just imagine the fun if you were on Strictly.
Could you go on Strictly so I could live my life vicariously through you? Because you could actually, you probably have been asked on Strictly. Now, I've got this friend who's reasonably well known, and he is asked on Strictly every year, and I'm like, go on it for me. And he's like, no, Bryony, that would be like lame. And I'm like, how could you say that? It would be amazing.
It would be lame if I was on it. Anyway, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had a really good time.
Right, Annie. So how are we going to take the next few weeks then? Her Spirit have got lots of things to help us through, haven't they?
Yeah, I think we're a little bit back to where we were a few months ago. I mean, the great thing about Her Spirit is the app is there. It's so established. There are some incredible classes and support on there. So I don't think anyone has to feel they're alone in terms of, you know, not having something to jump on to every day to see a kind of smiley face.
I think the other thing, I was talking about this yesterday, is that you can, you know, you sort of think, oh, I must set goals. And actually, Bryony sort of alluded to that point about, do you know what? We just need to get to the other side. And whatever it takes, you know, let's not make it too ambitious or too difficult.
I think you're absolutely right. And not putting pressure on yourself. You know, I heard a dreadful story today about a mother who took her own life because she felt she'd let her children down in lockdown in terms of homeschooling. And I think people have got to realise, and as much as I have been, you know, quite negative over the last few weeks, knowing that we're kind of where we were heading, you know, I thought to myself today, you know,
a brilliant saying that a great training partner that I used to have, Loretta Harrop, who won the silver medal at the Athens Games, this too shall pass, you know, and it will. And we have to remind ourselves that, you know, we will go back to some sort of normality. And I think that's, you know, what the Bryony was saying is you can't fast forward, but you've got to know that there will be an end to it at some point, as hard as it is for some people.
Yeah, and also that really important point that there is lots of different places. If you're feeling dark thoughts, whatever it is, you need to go and talk to somebody and get help.
Talk. I think there's very few people in this world that don't have someone to talk to. And what Bryony had to offer there at the end was brilliant in terms of charities that are still very much up and running. Your GP might not always be your first port of call. I think phoning one of those lines and actually talking to someone, because some people can be left very flat, not being able to get hold of their GP and thinking, right, I'll just part this up, you know, because GPs are busy or they're closed or whatever. I'm not saying don't go to your GP for one moment, but maybe chatting with someone and getting the advice as to where you should go and what you should do is a good thing. I don't know if you agree with me, Lou. I mean, I'm not advising people not to phone their GP, but there are a million charities out there where people are ready and waiting to talk to people that are in a disparate situation.
Yeah, I think Annie, yeah, GP definitely can help you access, but you know, also just that talking, that that first step, whether it's to a friend, whether, you know, you were to phone me up, I was to phone you up, whatever it is, it's the sort of, you know, be brave, not brave enough, just, you know, just there is help out there. Don't be scared of taking that first step. Oh, goodness me. Oh. How the chickens?
There's no eggs.
Still,
no, there's. I think they're in general protest, aren't they? There's no eggs. I think we've given up, and everyone keeps saying to me, "No, but they don't lay in the winter." But the reason we got the regular hybrids was because
that they would.
Yeah, I mean, I can see them from here in the garden. They're, you know, clucking around, having a great time. The sun's come out, but there are no eggs.
As soon as you do have eggs, will you send me a picture?
Yeah, I will, definitely.
And thanks to everybody for listening. We really appreciate all the interaction. We really appreciate that you've been part of this journey that we've been on, Annie, and we will continue into the future.
We will too.
Take care, my love.
Love and love. Bye.
Take care.
Hi, my name's Mel Berry and I'm one of the co-founders of Her Spirit. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. These podcasts would not have been made possible without the support of the brilliant MediChecks. MediChecks offer an easy and affordable way to check your health with their simple and personalized blood tests. From hormones and nutrition to cholesterol and diabetes, there is something for everyone. Just go to MediChecks.com to find out more. Have a great day.